Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, what's a progressive citizenry to do? It's been over a year since President Donald Trump was elected. People in liberal Seattle reacted to that event. They call it the incident here, in various ways. The individuals you'll hear in these talks switched careers, took a road trip to conservative Oregon, reflected on the balance between parenting and activism, sought ways to confront family divisions, and took up boxing. They also wrote thoughtful essays about their experiences, which have been published in the new anthology, Fly to the Assemblies, Seattle and the Rise of the Resistance. The collection was edited by South Seattle Emerald editor Marcus Harrison Green. This Town Hall Seattle-sponsored reading and discussion took place at the Rainier Arts Center on November 2nd. Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the event. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature.
The night of November 8th, I was a young editor-in-chief at the South Seattle Emerald, and I wasn't quite prepared for the election results, and I ended up stumbling home the two-mile walk from Hillman City to Rainier Beach. And, you know, as a friend of mine so delicately put it in those late hours of that night, all roads seemed to point to a destination called We're Screwed. Right? He said the F word, but I saw a kid in here, and I'm trying to respect. But anyway, at that point, it was so easy to believe that our country had failed us yet again, and that we were doomed to never learn from the atrocities of our past. That for anyone who ever fought for a just America, it was easy to believe that their roars were destined to always be treated as whispers. It was easy to think that their actions would always be the equivalent of hands submerged in a pot of water. And no matter how long those hands endured in that liquid, once they emerged, there would never be any evidence that they were ever there. There'd never be any testimony to the work they had done. But then words came to me from my favorite author of all time, James Baldwin. He once said that sometimes you have to look through the darkness of the past to find light. Sometimes you have to scavenge through the wreckage of history to find a remedy to the present. And in your searching, you find words that lead you to two things necessary to confront your present predicament. You find the complementary duo of hope and truth. You know, where hope is optimistic, truth owes us no comfort. Where hope is ephemeral, truth is stubbornly resilient. Where hope is visionary, truth is unequivocal. It was hope that I found in those wee hours, in the words of Howard Zinn, who said, "To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. And when we choose to emphasize in this complex history, what we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of the world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. Because all the future is an infinite succession of presents. And to live now, to love now, to act now, as we think human beings should live and act and love in defiance of all that is bad around us, is in itself a marvelous victory. And that night I also found truth. In the words of Dustin Washington, who contributed an essay to this collection. He happened to be next to me when the election night was unfolding and I was on my fifth rum and coke. He wrote, "I know many are hurt and scared right now, but this election clarifies where we are as a country. I appreciate the honesty of this election. Honesty is a gift. Honesty destroys all illusions. Honesty calls us to step into our individual and collective power. If you are awake, you will receive the deeper message of this moment in time. We always seek someone else to blame, but if you could see deep enough, you would see that this is a reflection on all of us, a reflection of us being out of our power and not having vision. If you didn't know how deep racism is in this country, now you do. If you didn't know how dark the shadow of America was and is, now you do. Us being able to see the shadow and the racism of this country is a gift. The truth is, Trump built a movement, a sick, racist, and hateful movement, but it was a movement. A movement always wins. It's time we build our movement, he said. And so I found that it's between that union of hope and truth that births an essential ingredient to a society, at least to a society continuing and flourishing, and that is faith. That is faith in the nation's people to emancipate a country that has never been free from patriarchy, never been free of racism, never been free from injustice, never been free from oppression. But it's faith in the people to guide it into a new way of life that has yet to exist, but that can exist, that can be. They say that that civil wars and making the world a better place have the same two things in common. It's not bullets that begin wars or a better world, it's words. It's words and their ideas. And so tonight, you're so lucky to have so many people who can bring words of hope and wisdom and faith to you tonight. And so it gives me such a great honor to introduce this wonderful pack of readers. First, you will have Christine Leon, educator and Town Hall Community Programs Coordinator, reading I Have No Grace Today. You will then have Monica Guzman, a Nieman Fellow and founder of The Evergrey, a wonderful daily newsletter. So please subscribe if you haven't already. Reading A 10-Hour Road Trip to Cross the Political Divide. We'll then have Sharon H. Chang, a wonderful human being, educator, Emerald columnist, and friend, reading Being an Activist Parent Post-Election. It'll then be followed up by Marilee Jolin, reading, who is our current ED of the Emerald, reading An Authentic Invitation. And then finally, we will have like the Mike Tyson of poetry, Reagan Jackson, 9th, 10th, 11th wonder of the world, reading an excerpt from her essay on fear and anger and fighting back. So without further ado, Kristen, please come to the stage. And thank you very much.
I'm kind of playing two roles today. I am so excited to be a part of this collection, and I'm also Town Hall's Community Programs Curator. I wrote this essay a year ago, so at the time I was not yet with Town Hall. I was actually a middle school humanities teacher. I didn't know at that time that 4 months later I would be leaving teaching to come to Town Hall, which was a bittersweet and very, very hard decision. But as I was getting ready to read today, I was reading over the essay again, and I could see where I was figuring out what I had to do next. And the world needs good teachers right now so, so badly. We need to be teaching critical thinking more than ever. But I also needed to be around other people who were activated and already doing critical thinking, and I just couldn't be more happy to be with Town Hall, and it's how I know Marcus, and so I'm grateful to be here for lots of reasons. Begins with a quote from Hillary Clinton. Sorry. To all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in this world to pursue and achieve your own dreams. Tell little girls whatever you want about their worth and potential, but this country just showed them who's boss, and it's not them. It's not any spray-tanned megalomaniac either. It's fear and hate. Donald Trump doesn't scare me. He's all fluffy hair and gold toilets and mail order steaks, whatever. It's the people who scare me. The one in red hats, but also the ones who didn't vote. The ones who threw away their vote in protest. All those white women who considered their options and decided, yes, I will vote for a man who defended himself against a flood of sexual assault accusations by explaining that those women were not attractive enough for him to grope. This is what internalized misogyny looks like. This is what deliberate, quiet, but stubborn racism looks like. Oh, she won the popular vote? So what? The fact is, millions of Americans said one thing out loud and then indulged in hate and fear in the voting booth when no one was looking. But now we're all looking at the numbers, at each other. We tweet our outrage and shock. But behind all that, we have fear inside of us too, now more than ever. And so we understand how this was possible. I didn't have any classes to teach today, the day after the presidential election. I was supposed to have conferences with my students' parents for 3 hours this afternoon, but I couldn't. I heard from my friends in the school building that the teachers were crying in the staff room, but the students were back in class as usual, asking for bathroom breaks and extensions on papers. They thought the teachers were acting weird today. The students at the school where I work are mostly Asian and white. We have almost no Black or Latino students. We have almost no students who live near or below the poverty line and get free or reduced lunch. The median income in the school's neighborhood is almost twice that of the rest of the country. One Asian girl in my sixth grade class's mock election explained on Monday that she would vote for Trump because his racism doesn't include Asians. She didn't mention anything about his stance on women. I thought it was funny at the time. While my partner was at work today and my son was at school, I wanted so badly to be surrounded by a community, but I wasn't sure my school was the community I was seeking. Maybe if I had showed up for conferences, I could have found some solace. We could have grieved together as parents and teachers, worried for our kids and ourselves. We could have mourned and then organized. Stronger together, Hillary Clinton said, and I still believe her. Forget his promised immediate dismantling of the U.S. Department of Education. What will we do now that any hope for people of color, queer people, Muslim people, and women has been burned to the ground? Can we have a conference about that? What could I have told the parents who I know would have showed up to dissect scores on their kids' recent vocabulary quizzes? How could I, in my bigly, braggadocious humanities teacher way, pretend now that learning vocabulary even matters at all, and needing evidence and reasoning to back up a claim and critical thinking? There is nothing left for English teachers to defend that this election hasn't proven to be completely meaningless. Everything I try to teach my students feels hollow now about bravery, about integrity, about empathy, about how the world will give back so much if we just engage with it. All my hard-fought optimism seems so ridiculous now. Fear and hate won. Lying won. Bullying won. Last minute, I didn't study, I'm just going to wing it, won. Misogyny and racism won again. How can any teacher be neutral now? I have no grace today. I heard her looking fierce and clear-faced in the color of royals tell us that we owe him a chance to lead. I heard her reach out to our little girls. I heard her nod subtly but firmly to our right to defend our values. But I didn't want to hear a concession speech. I wanted a rallying cry. I wanted the most qualified candidate to ever run for president of this heartbroken country to meet me at my despair and terror with rage and an action plan. Don't go so high that you leave us now, Hillary, please. I don't teach again until Monday. That's a long time for my tween students. It will be complicated to talk about unreliable narrators when we come back together, especially if I'm still crying, or if my sadness has given way to fury by then. We will make space for conversation either way. That feels a little like relief, to know I'll be back in the classroom next week, surrounded by sixth graders who, whether their candidate won or lost yesterday, get it that bullies never win the long game. Keep teaching, that's all I can do. Because even though I have very little hope for the present, my faith that our future voters will fix this mess is tremendous. Thank you.
Hi everyone, I'm Monica Guzman. I'm the co-founder of The Evergrey. And last November and December was obviously really difficult time for the city. To put a stat on it, 92% of Seattle voters did not vote for Donald Trump, which is behind only Detroit and I believe Washington, D.C. So in our newsletter, we're very close to our readers, and people shared all kinds of emotions, and we tried to stay close to the mood. Lots of fear, lots of anger, lots of wanting to do something, mobilization. We tried to activate and help people wherever they were. And one of the things people shared with us was curiosity, because there aren't a lot of people who voted for Trump around here. Could you help us meet, have conversations? Could you help us understand? So one day in December, a columnist at the Washington Post published an interactive map. And in the map, you could plug in the county that you live in the United States, and it would tell you what county nearest yours geographically voted the opposite of you, like exactly opposite. So it turns out the county that voted the opposite of King County, Washington, is Sherman County, Oregon. So we were going to drop that in the next day's newsletter, because it's interesting. But we also decided, well, why not ask if anybody would be interested in visiting Sherman County? And dozens of people said they were. And so then we had a choice. Do we actually try to plan a trip? What would it take to make that successful? What would it take to make it valuable and productive and human and somehow empathetic in this crazy climate we're in? We did a lot of work and we did the road trip. And this is the story we wrote afterward. A 10-hour road trip to cross political divides. Sherman County, Oregon, sits just south of the Washington border, east of the Cascades. Fewer than 2,000 people live in its 831 square miles. Stand on one of the hills near Morrow, the county seat, and you'll see wheat fields all around, and maybe some tall wind turbines. Sherman County has very little in common with Seattle and King County, and yet we're connected. It's the nearest county to ours that voted exactly opposite us in the presidential election. While 74% of King County voters went for Clinton, 74% of Sherman County voters went for Trump. So on Saturday, about 20 of us King County residents took a 10-hour road trip to pay the people of Sherman County a visit. We called the trip Melting Mountains, an urban-rural gathering. Sandy McNabb, a just-retired Sherman and Wasco County agricultural agent who planned the event with us, came up with the name. It refers to the snowmelt that runs down the mountains, dividing the eastern and western parts of our states, nourishing the land below. We like the metaphor. And though we know we can't melt the political and cultural mountains that divide our two counties in an afternoon, red versus blue, liberal versus conservative, rural versus urban, we figured we might help people take a first step. We pulled up to Oregon State University's Sherman County Extension Office a little after 11 a.m. About 4 hours, one meal, and many conversations later, we said goodbye to the 16 Sherman County residents we'd met to start the long drive back home. The people who took part in the discussions told each other whom they'd voted for, revealed their stance on some big issues, talked about the hopes and concerns they had about their country over the next few years, and practiced listening to each other for minutes at a time with instructions not to interrupt. Here's how they thought it went. I wasn't sure what to expect, said Jennifer Zimmerly, who is from Sherman County. I can't lie. There was a little trepidation. In one exercise, people from Sherman and King counties paired off for a series of one-on-one conversations. In each of those, one person asked the other about his or her political hopes, concerns, and values, and listened to the response. Then they switched. I was afraid it'd be a lot more Clinton versus Trump stuff, said Jennifer, who voted for third-party candidate Gary Johnson. Instead, what we got was some really nice guided discussions on the fact that even though how we approach problems is different, in the end, we truly are looking for the same thing. The group came to that shared purpose early in the event when everyone took turns introducing themselves. People in both counties agreed our divides had turned ugly, that they wanted to learn from each other, that this could be a start. There's a lot I don't know about my own country, one person said. There's a lot that has to happen before people unfamiliar with someone else's lifestyle can really understand it. Knowing that left Darren Padgett, a fourth-generation Sherman County wheat farmer, a little disappointed. No one went out in the street and protested or had a baseball bat and did bad things, said Darren, who serves as chair of the Oregon Wheat Commission. That was the positive of the day, having a civil conversation. The negative, he said, is that he didn't get an opportunity to connect that deeply with city dwellers about how he lives his life. When he introduced himself, he pointed to the sandwiches that people were eating for lunch. If you knew what it took to get that simple sandwich on your plate, he said, to murmurs of thoughtful agreement from residents of both Sherman and King counties in the room. I would have appreciated a better opportunity to explain to them what we do and why we do it, he said. Darren said his healthcare costs jumped 426% in the last few years, and regulations like the Waters of the United States rule, which President Trump ordered the EPA to remove last month, are hurting his business. That's why I support Donald Trump and not Hillary Clinton, Darren said. I didn't think either of them was a very good candidate, to be honest with you. Jordan Goldwarg came from King County with his husband, Sam, and would have voted for Clinton if he could have. Jordan, who grew up in Canada, became a U.S. citizen just a few weeks ago. And by the way, this trip was in March. At one point during the one-on-one discussions, Jordan heard the person he was paired with from Sherman County share a viewpoint on LGBTQ rights that made him uncomfortable. The person made it clear, Jordan said, that she had no problem with gay people. But for me, as someone who is gay, the general tone of the conversations and the things she was saying that affect my life and the lives of a lot of people that I know, it was just difficult to hear, Jordan said. Jordan wished he had more time to unpack the divisions that turned up, but he didn't want to stop listening. I really value the opportunity to have conversations with people who seem different from me, to be able to understand their experiences more and develop empathy with them, said Jordan, who is the regional director for a nonprofit that brings together people of different faiths. It seems this is exactly the kind of experience I'd been wanting to have and I didn't know how to find. Like many people around Seattle, Leah Greenbaum woke up shocked November 9th. For weeks, she consumed online and social media trying to make sense of the election results through news articles and the explanations they laid out. Going to Sherman County and being in person, I think, I was surprised by the complexity of the stories I heard, she said. They made sense to her in a way that the online stories she had read could not. To stand in front of someone and hear them speak with passion and feeling about what they believe, you sort of can't help but expand your own sense of empathy and humanity, Leah said. Leah is a graduate student at the University of Washington's Evans School of Public Policy and Governance. When she heard people from Sherman County talk about how certain regulations and policies affected them, she asked herself how she could make sure the policies she works on are always informed by people's actual experiences. I want to get out there and talk to primary sources from now on, she said. I love the media, my best friends are journalists, but I'm not going to look for easy answers anymore. Others came away with things they wanted to do next. Jennifer said she planned to email every person who came from King County and shared their contact info to thank them for coming down. Darren said he's going to follow up with a couple he met from King County and send them photos and material to continue a conversation they started on the Waters of the U.S. rule. We, farmers, need to tell our story as much as we can, he said. Jordan said he wants to think about more ways to bridge urban and rural communities in his interfaith work. And for us at the Evergrey, we're going to look for ways to help keep these conversations going. Tomorrow we'll be sharing more perspectives, in people's own words, from people who took part in Melting Mountains. And we want to find more ways to facilitate conversations among people who disagree. I know that when people pay attention to how they're speaking and listening to one another and really make an attempt to understand, remarkable things can happen, said Bob Staines, a conversation facilitator who advised us on this event. On that, we agree.
My essay, Being an Activist Parent Post-Election. So I was not political most of my younger years. My parents are very biased, bigoted people, so I grew up around a lot of that. I didn't wake up until I gave birth to my son. Met my partner and then gave birth to my son. We're all mixed race identifying people. So really, for me, being woke and being politicized is very tied up into transitioning into motherhood and family. And I will always see it that way. That was the birth of my activist identity. And at the same time, being an activist and being a parent, as most parents know, you're juggling constantly, right? There's always like a million things to do, and you're trying to be yourself, and you're trying to be a parent, and you're trying to love your kid and support who they are. So there's always this juggling. Doing that when you're an activist and you're trying to be political is a very unique, particular experience that can be really challenging, really frustrating, and also really enlightening. And I think that my son is an integral part of that process that I can never remove. And I think I'll look back later and just be really wowed by that. So I'm really glad I wrote this piece. It was really a heart piece that I was reacting to the election and sort of thinking through a lot of emotions following. But as I look at it now, as time has passed, I just feel like it's a great thing to be able to keep revisiting and keep considering this parenthood and this activist identity and my relationship with my family and my son. So, being an activist parent post-election. On election day, I had every intention of getting my 7-year-old to bed on time, but we stayed up late, glued to the TV. It felt critical. Eventually, he passed out exhausted on the futon, while my husband and I continued to stare horrified at the screen. After our worst fears were confirmed, my husband carried our boy downstairs and laid him in bed. On Wednesday, my son awoke and asked immediately, "Who won?" When he heard the result, his face fell. "Did all the Muslims get kicked out of the country?" "No," I assured him, "it's okay for now." He asked how long Trump would be president, and I told him 4 years. "That means I'll be 11 years old when Trump kills me." I was shocked. Whoa, Trump isn't gonna kill you, you're gonna be fine. He looked back at me a little shamefaced, "but I feel like he's gonna kill me." On Thursday, I needed community. Excuse me, I need to also move this mic up. I was experiencing the worst insomnia of my adult life. Anybody else have that experience around that time? And knew my fears and anxieties were running deep. Got Green, woo, was holding a post-election conversation for mourning, healing, and to talk about impacts upon communities of color. Of course I was going. At the conversation, I stayed upstairs with the grown-ups. My son went downstairs to childcare. I didn't have time to feed him. He didn't like the food at the event and ended up eating potato chips and chocolate for dinner. On Friday, I needed to get active. I helped organize a family child-centered post-election dialogue in collaboration with Families of Color Seattle. ED is in the house. We drew monsters to help children outlet their feelings and superheroes to tap into their power and strength. I sketched a flaming monster and myself sitting small and sad next to it. My son's monster looked like a tiny blue octopus. "Look, Mom, I made a germ and I'm gonna draw myself big so I don't have to look at it." And if you look at this essay in the Emerald, there's a picture of him holding our picture and you can actually see what we both drew. That night, I was photographer for a woman and trans people of color healing cipher, part of a national hashtag R100 movement to bring forward the voices of survivors of color in response to the gendered violence of Trump's campaign. It was a small sacred space, and I didn't want my son interrupting while people were grieving together, so I sat him in a corner with the iPad, and he played games by himself for hours. On Saturday, at home, there were no groceries, laundry wasn't done, the house was filthier than it had been in months. I still wasn't sleeping. I was ragged, on edge, raw. I went to an equity training for work where, of course, we talked about the election. My son went to childcare again. When I picked him up, he was so hungry, he cried. I gave him a bagel and grapes I'd grabbed at the training. On Monday, see, I'm still going. Did anybody else hyperfunction after the election to cope, right? On Monday, I got a press release that Seattle students were walking out in protest. Even though Monday is our family day, I had a gut feeling I needed to get out there too and photograph. My husband picked up our son at school while I was marching. When I was done, the two of them came to get me. But I was tired and distracted. Later that evening, my best friend, who is trans and part of our chosen family, was verbally assaulted by transphobic men. They cited Trump's presidency as license for their violence. 1 week post-election, the following Wednesday, we were driving home from school when my son solemnly said, "Mom, do you like me?" "What do you mean?" I exclaimed. "I love you. Why do you ask me that?" "Because," he answered frankly, "you never play with me." He whimpered, sleeping that night, had a nightmare about cavemen, woke at 2:30 a.m., went back to sleep, had another nightmare about giants, woke again, and couldn't go back to sleep at all. My heart fell a million miles and shattered into pieces on the ground. Tonight, we were supposed to go to the Youth Speak Seattle Poetry Slam series kickoff with my best friend, and I couldn't do it. Instead, I texted my friend what had happened and that I felt like, apologies, shit-awful mother. They instantly wrote back, "You're not a shit-awful mom. Shit is fucking complicated right now. We are all doing the best we can." For sure. These last weeks have been terrifying for so many of us in similar and different ways. Now, so these statistics are kind of old, but if you can imagine, they exist within the moment that I wrote this essay. The Southern Poverty Law Center has collected more than 400, now 700 reports of hateful intimidation and harassment since the election. The vast majority of these post-election hate incidents have been anti-immigrant and anti-Black and have occurred at K-12 schools and universities. That report alone would be enough to send any parent into a tailspin. And certainly the question, what do we tell our children, has loomed incredibly large since fateful election night, as epitomized beautifully by Van Jones's impassioned CNN commentary. Does anyone remember that? Yeah. I have seen a maybe unprecedented but telling increase to reach out to families with resources, support, space for how to deal with bigotry. As hate rises and the president-elect continues to announce alarming appointment after appointment, including climate change deniers, far-right figures and nationalists, earning wide praise from white supremacists and neo-Nazis, it is absolutely right and important to feel worried, scared, scattered, and energized to fight. But as you can see, the formula for family resistance is, well, complicated. Certainly my son is frightened and wants equity as much as me, but I can skip meals if I need to get something done. As a growing young person, he can't. I can have sleepless nights and say, "Oh, it's insomnia," but he can't. I need to talk and talk and talk about it some more. He can talk some, but then he needs to talk about other things like stories, jokes, Pokemon cards, Minecraft. I need to organize. He needs to play with me. Simply put, he needs me to take care of him to be strong in his resistance. It all begs super important questions about how we sustain being active and political when we're caregivers. Not only are there many forces encouraging depoliticization of families in this racist, sexist, classist, xeno-Islama, trans, and homophobic country, but that push to depoliticize is compounded enormously when there's meals to be made, cleaning to do, errands to run, and so much to lose if the caring of our loved ones falls to the wayside. I am an author, scholar, activist. Understandably, I kicked into hyper overdrive post-election, as many activists have. It's a lot. Still, I'm proud of and honored to do the work I do. I feel an urgency to do it now, of course, more than ever, and plan to propel forward. I'm also the mother of a young child and partner to a husband who works long self-employed hours. I keep moving by taking my son with me to a lot of things. I have always believed firmly that it was good for him. That remains true. We've had incredible conversations before, during, and post-election. Yet it can and does take a toll. While every working mother feels the heart pull of work versus family, the context of my political efforts are very specific, especially now. I still lie awake middle of the night and worriedly scroll my Facebook feed to see what new awful appointments have been made, what actions are being planned, how people are doing. It's easy to get overwhelmed, fatigued, spread thin, short-tempered. At the same time, there's the conviction to keep going hard because the stakes are so high. So where is the solution to this seemingly impossible equation? In the end, it's been my 7-year-old who has had sage wisdom to give to me. By the way, he's about to turn 8 on Sunday, so he won't be 7 much longer. Yes, it's crucial to get out there. However, balance matters. Sometimes staying home and re-energizing is the revolution. It's important to care, but it's important to care for ourselves too. That, I think, must be the key to plugging in and sustaining. Being a politicized family, whatever that family looks like, means we daily work to make change. And no matter what's going on in the world, we simultaneously work to be together, break bread, and have fun whenever and wherever we can. With our love for each other nourished solid in place, I suspect we can never be broken. As my son said, get frustrated, but don't get too frustrated. And you know what? I believe we're really going to need his advice to dodge hopelessness in the days ahead. Thanks for keeping it real, son. Let's have a play date today. Thank you.
My name is Marilee Jolin. I'm really proud to be involved with the South Seattle Emerald and really proud to be included in this anthology. I'm going to continue the theme of family here in a different role that I have. This is a reflection about my role as a daughter and the experience of how the incident, I really like that, I'm going to borrow that, prompted me to be a little more bold in my relationship with my parents. An authentic invitation. I stopped talking to my parents about politics in 2001. By that point, the chasm between us had just gotten too wide. It didn't seem worth the effort or the risk. I feared impassioned arguments. I feared derision and judgment. I feared damaging the relationship. And, unfortunately, took a certain amount of ego-boosting pride in not attempting. I can't talk to my parents at all, I'd say to my progressive liberal friends, rolling my eyes. I'd exaggerate the extent of the conservative evangelical fanaticism I experienced in church growing up. I'd wear my martyr badge with pride at how far I'd come, inferring how impossible it is for the less enlightened to make that arduous journey. I'm embarrassed now remembering those conversations, embarrassed at how self-righteous and self-congratulatory I was, and how unfair it was to my parents, because in truth, I hadn't even given them a chance. I'd condemned them without ever having invited them. In the lead up to the 2016 election, I still couldn't bring myself to talk to my parents, even as it became more and more likely Donald Trump would be elected. I told myself that since our state's electoral votes would never go to him, it didn't matter, even if they voted Trump. But it did matter, not because of the Electoral College, because I was distancing myself from my family, missing my foremost opportunity to live out my beliefs and ignoring my responsibility to educate the people in my life. Because I was excluding and isolating instead of inviting. Leave it to European descent to not let me get away with that. And if y'all don't know what European descent is, I'll read you a little footnote here. European descent is a collective of white folks which exists to actively analyze and change the way we as whites participate in racism, personally, culturally, and institutionally. We make a commitment to undo racism personally in our families, social life, workplaces, and community work. That's a quote from the European Descent National Statement recently released. And also just a very active kind of kick-ass group of white folks in this area that hold regular meetings that I'm have had the privilege of taking being a part of from time to time. It was a few weeks after Trump's election and the church fellowship hall was packed. I tried counting all the people crammed together. Even after opening the heavy wooden doors to the sanctuary so we could spread out a bit, and lost track around 500. There were far more than that. The energy in the room was palpable. For many people, it was their first meeting, and the combination of nerves, guilt, anticipation, and anger was thick in the air. These white folks were feeling some feelings and seriously unsure what to do with it all. As always, the small group discussions were the most impacting. Sitting uncomfortably in my folding chair, listening to the other white folks in my discussion group share about the difficulties and joys of talking to family members with different political beliefs, I realized with chagrin and shame that I'd never even considered talking to my parents about race in America. In listening to the other white folks at the meeting, I knew I couldn't stay silent anymore. If I can't talk to my family, who can I talk to? How can I pretend I'm working for social justice, resisting this racist regime, if I'm not willing to do the work in my own family? So, with their encouragement ringing in my ears and a belly full of conviction, I went online to order some books. Ever the non-confrontational Seattleite, I failed to start an actual conversation that Thanksgiving holiday. Instead, I waited till Friday morning when everyone was packing up. Then I removed the three books I'd brought: Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, and Bell Hooks' Ain't I a Woman. I carefully pulled them from my bag, placed them gently on the kitchen counter, and walked away. It was not a Chariots of Fire moment by any stretch. I did not push past the clutching panic to force out words I knew needed speaking. I didn't have an earth-shattering conversation with tears and yelling that changed my view of myself forever. Honestly, I took the easiest way out humanly possible. But the beauty is that it worked. And I believe it worked because I didn't push myself too far. I didn't take a flying leap off a 12-foot cliff into raging rapids, just slowly ascended the stairs into the 4-foot chlorinated pool. I didn't try to turn 180 degrees in my passive-aggressive, conflict-phobic family structure, just a small pivot toward authenticity. It was a gentle pivot, but an honest one. It was a genuine invitation. My dad picked up the books and said, "Are these for me?" I said, "Yep, for you and Mom." And then quickly, before I could chicken out, "These books have been profoundly meaningful to me, so I wanted to share them with you, and I hope we can talk about them." How often do our national political struggles cause us to think so far outside ourselves, so far away from home, that we become overly focused on the extremes and forget about the painful systemic racism embedded within our families and ourselves? We get caught up in the idea of forcefully changing minds or defeating the opposition, and neglect the simple but difficult conversations in our own families. Conversations that for many of us would be with the white moderates Dr. King wrote of from the Birmingham jail, who are more devoted to order than justice. In the wake of Trump's election, I was challenged to take my first mincing, embarrassing steps toward those important conversations. I fumbled and hemmed and hawed and took the easy way out, but I did it. And what has come of this attempt is pure beauty. Because, beyond my wildest imaginings, my parents' worlds were also rocked by Michelle Alexander, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and Bell Hooks. My father has left me far in the dust as he devours book after book: Michael Eric Dyson, Cornel West, James Baldwin. What began as me loaning him my favorite authors has now become a growing pile of books next to my nightstand as I strive to keep pace. He's starting a book group at his church with The New Jim Crow and has shared this important book with friends and family, inviting folks into the conversation I never would have asked. And possibly, I think, that's how a truly cross-political movement builds. Because my father still watches Fox News. I haven't changed his mind about every topic, and I likely won't, because ultimately, it isn't about changing minds. It's about building relationships and inviting people in. And so the movement grows, one fumbling book exchange at a time. Thank you.
I'm Reagan Jackson, and I really enjoyed this. This has been really cool listening to everybody again. We did this once before, and it's interesting to reflect on where I was when I wrote this piece and where I am now, and all the things that have happened in between. And yeah, I don't know. So here we go. Jab, jab, straight. V dip, hook punch. I keep my feet moving and my guard up in sync with my partner. It's the 11th session of a 14-week boxing class called We Fight Back, and we are finally sparring. My shirt is soaked through with sweat, and my muscles are screaming, but I am grinning through my mouth guard. I've needed this. It's been 16 years since the last time I wore a pair of boxing gloves. I was lighter then. In the best shape of my life, I am a different fighter now, more grounded and strategic. Even with less stamina, my punches knock my partner back a few steps and land with a satisfying thud. I love sparring. The adrenaline, the sweat, the way power feels in my body. When I'm fighting, it's one of the few times when I feel like all of me is in alignment. My mind is never clearer. But my love of fighting has always been complicated by my relationship to violence. Throughout childhood, my dad tried to get me involved in martial arts, but I considered myself a pacifist until middle school, when bullying reached a fevered pitch. Though I never started a fight, almost daily the fight found me. At some point, I stopped worrying about hurting people and started worrying about them hurting me. A boy in my class hit me with a brass-edged folder, slicing a gash just a quarter inch beneath my eye. Any higher, and I would have been permanently blind. As it was, I had to get stitches. I was humiliated. But worse, I was angry. This was no casual emotion. It was a raw, primal, incredible Hulk anger, what bell hooks would call a killing rage. Every time I saw that kid, I wanted to smash his face in. And I began to have violent fantasies, each more warped than the next. My rage became a source of shame and fear, confirmation that I was truly a terrible person. My parents were concerned. My dad kept pushing me to take karate, but I steadfastly refused because I didn't trust myself. I thought, shit, if somebody actually teaches me how to fight, I might kill someone. I didn't start boxing until my senior year of college. My junior year was simultaneously the best and the worst of my life. The rage that I had been so careful to suppress rose up in me larger than ever, and it would not go away. I was assaulted. And afterwards, I was mad at every person, place, or situation that had ever made me feel powerless. It was the kind of fury that burns you from the inside out like acid. I had to put it somewhere. So I started boxing. After a year of boxing, I got the opportunity to move to Japan. I traded fighting for meditating. I didn't fight again for several years when I took up Taekwondo. In 2010, I received my black belt before another travel opportunity took me away from my training. It was getting my black belt that cured me from fearing my own power. With skill came discipline, and being in control of my own body gave me the peace that I had been searching for. I have endured an entire lifetime of people fucking with me. Even now, I feel like I am constantly fighting to assert my humanity, to be allowed to live in this world. I think that's why boxing feels so satisfying. Because for 1 hour a week, when I feel the world pummeling me, I can finally punch back. I can take all the rage and sadness and righteous indignation, shove it into my fist, and punch until my arms are sore and I can't breathe. Now trapped in the waking nightmare of having a president-elect endorsed by the KKK, the fight has only begun. We have elected a bully who has effectively normalized openly racist, Islamophobic, and misogynistic behavior. Hate crimes are already on the rise, and it's no surprise when I turn on the news and our nation's leader is up on rape charges and caught on video unapologetically laughing about how he assaults women. So much of my life's work has been around stopping male violence against women and challenging gender-based violence that I'm so sick of women being raped and murdered and brutalized and beaten, confessed Ann Matheson when asked what inspired the creation of We Fight Back. Matheson and Megan Murphy, both social workers, teamed up about 2.5 years ago to pilot the first class. I wanted to create an opportunity for women to fight and defend themselves from violence, but I wanted them to be able to do that for free, said Matheson. So I reached out to a friend of mine who is an MMA instructor. The first project involved 8 women, including Murphy and Matheson. In addition to learning physical skills for self-defense, they hosted concurrent conversations about gender-based violence. While the program is open to all women, Murphy and Matheson wanted to make sure it addressed the fact that women of color, queer and trans-identified women, are disproportionately impacted by violence. The women in my cohort are a diverse mix of 20 and 30-somethings, some first-time fighters and some, like me, returning after a long break. There's a camaraderie that has grown between us over the past months. All of us have our own personal relationship to violence and fighting, some with more trauma than others, but despite the different motivations, our goal is the same: to prepare ourselves for the inevitability of a fight. After a short physical training, there's a break. Then boxers trade gloves for pens and notepads and reconvene for an hour of curriculum facilitated by Murphy and Matheson. Often, we begin with a meditation or a centering, a reminder that we are more than just bodies fighting, that we are minds, hearts, and spirits too. Sometimes, there are experiential activities that get us on our feet and in our voices, and always there are robust conversations. I'm the person that comes up with the drills and the focus and themes behind each class every week, says boxing coach Olivia Mendez. Prior to the start of any class, we sat and thought about all the components. Number one, who are we working with and what do they want to know? Mendez began boxing 15 years ago after a bad breakup left her searching for an outlet for pent-up emotions. I think one of the canons that we fight back speaks to is that myself as a woman growing up, when and where I didn't have a lot of opportunities to experience my emotions, says Mendez. I really struggled with how to cope with confrontation. This seems to be a common refrain. What do you do when conflict occurs? In our last class, Mendez described the 3 most common gut reactions: fight, flight, or freeze. We separated into 3 groups based on our default reactions, then we boxed around operating from that paradigm. After years of running away from my anger and trying to avoid conflict, I finally succumbed to my base reflex, to fight. The first round, I gave no quarter. I used my size to force my partner back. And then the next round, Coach Mendez asked us to practice using a different response. For 3 whole minutes, I had to freeze instead of punching. It's one thing to take a punch and then to return fire, and totally a different feeling to just stand there. Though running away isn't my default either, when I practiced boxing on the defensive, it at least gave me a sense that I was doing something, blocking and ducking. But just standing there frozen, I felt like a victim. While it's been good to get back into my body and to engage with an incredible community of women and to experience the release that fighting provides, participating in We Fight Back has also brought to the surface a deep-seated grief. I'm tired of always having to fight back, of being told not to walk at night, of being made to feel as though my basic human rights are privileges. This war I'm fighting is not against men or white people, but against the white supremacist heteronormative patriarchy, which has done everything in its power to create, sustain, and normalize bullying and rape culture. We live in an environment where we learn early on that our bodies are not our own, that we should expect to be judged by how we choose to dress or how willing we are to be complicit in our own victimization. It's exhausting, and it's not just happening here, it's happening all around the world, but so is the resistance. More than a class, a community, or even free boxing lessons, We Fight Back is a declaration that women are ready to stand in their power. That's what keeps me coming back week after week, knowing that I'm not only contributing to my own strength and self-empowerment, but that I am a part of a broader movement demanding justice in my community. And please know that you are also a part of this movement, if you choose to be.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This Town Hall Seattle-sponsored reading and discussion took place at the Rainier Arts Center on November 2nd. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.